Slate Money is brought to you by Harry's, the shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit harrys.com for $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MONEY. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you tap directly into the world's most popular magazines, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. Dive deeper into Vogue, People, Esquire, Time, and hundreds more, with interactive content for a richer reading experience. Right now, try Texture for free at texture.com/slatemoney. And by BowlandBranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off, plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, and more at BowlandBranch.com. That's BOLLANDBRANCH.com and use the promo code MONEY.
Hello! And welcome to the Too Big to Fail episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as ever, by the newly empurpled Kathy O'Neill, the blogger and data scientist from mathbabe.org.
So happy to be here.
Who has astonishingly excellent hair and cardigans this week.
Thank you. You look nice too, Felix.
which I'm very sad that our podcast listeners can't see your hair because it's got amazing tonality. We have Jordan Weissman, the Moneybox columnist from Slate.
I just want to elaborate a little on Kathy's sweater, which is that right now she's wearing a merino wool cardigan that she knitted herself in 4 days in like this kind of fan sunburst pattern of purple and like tan. It's amazing. It's a thing to behold.
By the way, it's really easy to knit a lot when your book is done. You like suddenly have all this energy.
So we're gonna try and plug Kathy's book every week for the next 9 months until it comes out in September. But it's available for pre-order.
It is, and we have a cover now. It's amazing.
So it's called
Weapons of Math Destruction.
Boom, boom, boom. Okay. So here's the thing. We, up until late last night, we thought this was going to be a kind of sad face episode about Neil Kashkari and his Too Big to Fail talk, because we didn't have anyone who actually knows anything about central bankers. But then, just by sheer amazing providence, the one and only Neil Irwin dropped in our lap, and there is literally no one better to talk about central bankers than Neil Irwin, who, I'm going to use the word again, literally wrote the book on them. What's your book?
The book is The Alchemist's Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire, but I don't have purple hair, so does that count?
You
still counts.
Good hair. I mean, Neil's always had good hair. So Neil is here to help us talk through kind of one of the most astonishing pieces of central bankery news in the past few years, frankly. I mean, came way out of left field this week. Neil Kashkari. Neil, who is Neil Kashkari?
Well, he is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota, of Minneapolis, rather.
So he's not the same as Narayana Kocherlakota.
He is not. He is
These
not.
These names
he has
are
the same
awesome,
job.
Though. The, same job,
the Minneapolis
same
Fed has
That's how they
the...
got the job, I think, because their names were cool.
But Neil Kashkari, he's an interesting guy. He's only been in the job a couple of months. His background is very different from what most people at the Federal Reserve is. He's not an economist. He was a Goldman Sachs investment banker 10 years ago, joined the Hank Paulson Treasury Department, and ended up running the bailout in 2008, the TARP, the bank bailout. That was his baby. He ran that for the Bush and then the Obama treasuries, was then kind of in the wilderness for a while, literally. He was chopping wood.
Was that Washington Post?
It was, yeah.
There was this fantastic Washington Post profile of him, complete with video, sort of wearing a flannel shirt and chopping wood and being a mountain man.
How did I miss that? He ran for governor of California, too.
And Senate, I think.
No, it was governor.
Oh, governor?
He ran for governor. We actually talked about him on a past episode, but I think the gist is that, I mean, well, when he ran for governor, he literally said, "I own TARP." Like, that was his, he, like, really embraced it. And I think, you know, the gist is that this is a guy who is, like, not an anti-bank warrior. Like, no one really thought
He was Hank Paulson's like favorite Goldman person, to the point at which Hank like dragged him over to Treasury from Goldman Sachs.
Right. And he ran, again, a $700 billion bank bailout that was perhaps the most unpopular program in government history. It was effective, you can argue, that the global financial system didn't collapse. But yeah, that whatever you think of the bank bailouts, that was his baby. He did it.
And now what he has done is he came out with this speech, which sounded like a Bernie Sanders stump speech, basically. He came out with this speech, and actually, frankly, a lot of Republicans, especially on the right, have been saying much the same thing, saying, we've got to end too big to fail, which to me is just a sign of a stupid. Like, when people say, we've got to end too big to fail, I'm like, this is a stupid thing to say. We're going to come into this. We're going to spend basically the entire episode
talking
about
this. Wait, why is it stupid?
I know. We're going to have a fight.
We're going to talk about this. He has three specific ways that he thinks that we can end too big to fail, which we're going to talk about one in each segment. So this is going to be a super wonky, nerdy thing. We're going to try and make it as fun as central banking and macroprudential policy can possibly be.
I think you start, Felix, by not using the word macroprudential. But
No. That's where the fun begins.
But yeah, so let's begin, Jordan, with the obvious one, which is, he's like, the banks are too big and we need to break them up.
Yeah, so this is especially interesting coming from someone who's currently on the Fed right now. And you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about like how much power and influence a regional Fed president has. But, you know, anyone who's been paying attention to the presidential election knows Bernie Sanders has been talking about wanting to bring back Glass-Steagall, which was the old separation between commercial and investment banking, which would itself break up some of the largest financial institutions in the country. But also, he has this other idea now that you could use a piece of Dodd-Frank that essentially allows the Federal Reserve to break, or the Federal Reserve and then this additional committee of regulators to vote and by regulatory fiat break up financial institutions that are considered some sort of immediate risk to the financial system.
Well, it's not an immediate risk. He's quite clear about that. He's saying that the risk is not immediate, but if the economy winds up in another recession or credit crunch or something like we saw in 2008, then the failure of those institutions would be a systemic thing.
That is what Kashkari is saying. Sanders has been saying he would use this piece of the Fed's powers to try and just break up the banks pretty much within his first year.
Well, Kashkari agrees with him. He's saying that we should break up the banks now so that they're not too big to fail in the event of a crisis. Well, he's not saying that there's an immediate risk now.
And now, so this is the thing that's interesting, is it's not, you know, Kashkari didn't come out and say, I agree with Bernie Sanders' plan to break up the banks using this regulatory rule. He's just like, it might be a good idea to break them up. He didn't really get into how to do it. And so,
but the timing is fascinating because there's this famous quote from Rahm Emanuel saying that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste and that you should implement like all manner of, you know, important things when you have a crisis because it allows you to do certain things. What Neil Kashkari is saying here is kind of the opposite. He's saying when we're in the middle of a crisis, we're busy putting out fires and there's things we have to do, like bailing out banks, which we don't like to do, but we have to do them. Now that we're not in a crisis is the time to do things like breaking up banks, which you can't do when you're in a crisis.
And I like that about, I mean, look, I'll be honest, I like a lot of things he said this week. But one of the things you heard a lot of in the crisis, especially from people that are running TARP, is like, don't ask us to do more right now because we're just trying to keep the economy from falling apart. Come back to us in a little while. And then they were hoping that no one would actually remember that. And Kashkari's basically like, yeah, let's make good on that promise because it's important. And he's right.
And I think if you think back to that, you know, winter, spring of 2009, really dark time, there was a lot of pressure on the Obama administration, on Tim Geithner to break up the banks, to nationalize Citigroup and Bank of America. They didn't go that path. They went this path of, you know, trying to implement Dodd-Frank and trying to keep the financial system as it existed solid. When you hear Bernie Sanders say the biggest banks are bigger than they were before the crisis, the reason is because the big banks were the tool the government used to try and contain the crisis. So J.P. Morgan bought Bear Stearns. Barclays bought the Lehman Brothers assets. So you had this system where the last men standing of the big banks were able to kind of bring in the failing institutions and keep credit flowing in the economy and keep the crisis from being worse. But the outcome is exactly what Neil Kashkari and Bernie Sanders are saying. You have bigger banks.
So in his speech, Kashkari actually went a little further than what we said, and I just wanted to bring it up, which is that he talked about how the banks, because of Dodd-Frank, were required to write these living wills, which was supposed to be a way for them to describe what would happen in the case that they were in trouble. And Kashkari said the living wills are probably not sufficient, even in a moment of crisis for a bank, but not a systemic crisis.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit here and talk about this concept of too big to fail, which is a really important concept, certainly for anyone who lived through the financial crisis, which is all of us.
I prefer not to remember it, but
the idea, and it's an old one. It predates the financial crisis. Is basically that, especially in a crisis, but sometimes even when you're really big, when you're not in a crisis, if you're a systemically important financial institution, as these things are known now, then you can't fail, because the failure of one bank, even though it's a private sector bank, is so interconnected to so many different other banks and so many other parts of the economy that it would basically just bring the entire economy crashing down. And you can't afford to do that, so you have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to prevent it, and people hate that. And the slogan is, this bank is too big to fail. And it is a real thing. And what happened during Dodd-Frank is that a bunch of Republicans, actually, mostly, started saying, we need to end too big to fail, as though too big to fail is some kind of government policy which the government decides you're too big to fail, therefore we'll bail you out. No, it's not a government policy. It's simply a descriptor of certain banks. My feeling is, and this is why I'm just going to come in, you know, and be sort of me about this, is my feeling is you can't end it because it's just a thing that exists. You can break up the banks, but you could break up J.P. Morgan into 20 different bits, and there would be some of those 20 which are still too big to fail. I mean, Lehman Brothers, we discovered the hard way, was too big to fail. And Lehman Brothers is tiny compared to someone like J.P. Morgan.
Okay, I agree with you, but I want to be more nuanced about it. I think there's really two different topics here. One is too big to fail specific banks that are just, that have this moral hazard thing where they know they're going to be bailed out, blah, blah, blah. The other thing is complexity. That the system itself is too complex. And
absolutely.
For that, in that secondary thing, you're right that breaking up the big banks isn't going to improve the complexity a priori. We have to sort of intentionally improve the complexity. And Neil Kashkari didn't talk about that. He only talked about the first thing.
Yeah, look, too big to fail might be the wrong terminology. It's kind of become the accepted terminology. But think about two different banks. Sorry, Wells Fargo, giant bank all over the country. But their business is basically what you think of as a bank. They take deposits. They make loans. They're a very large bank, but they do kind of standard banking business. Take a Goldman Sachs. It's a smaller balance sheet than Wells Fargo, but way more complicated, way harder to manage, way more arguably systemic risk that if they were to fail, something bad would happen in the global economy. I think as a regulator, as a policymaker, you have to think of those in different buckets. And sometimes when we just talk about size as its own
okay,
challenge.
Okay, but let me ask you, if you broke up J.P. Morgan into two or three or four constituent parts, would that help?
So I kind of agree with you. I'm skeptical that, you know, what really matters is the function that these different arms of a JP Morgan or a Citigroup do, how leveraged they are, I'm sure we'll get to capital in a minute. And how broad the ripples would be if they did fail, and what the risk of them failing is, given how much leverage they use.
So the derivatives arm of J.P. Morgan, say, even if it got spun off into its own institution, that one thing would still be too big to fail, and so you don't really solve any problem by breaking it up.
Well, let me try to jump in here. Like, I agree that it wouldn't be sufficient to break it up. I think that's the first step.
Why is it necessary?
Well, right now what we have is, like, if J.P. Morgan, one part of it goes bad, then it seeps into all the rest of J.P. Morgan. And so we're bailing out something enormous. So theoretically, if we broke it up into 100 different small things, that would be an improvement.
Well,
let me
push back on that, because we had that. We had that in real life. We had the chief investment office of J.P. Morgan went bad in London. There was this, you know, famous London whale trade where they lost $6 billion. And it didn't seep into anything precisely because JP Morgan is so huge and so profitable that the bank could absorb those losses very easily.
Right. Well, sometimes that's true. Sometimes that is an example where size is helping them. But in a systemic crisis, that's probably not going to happen. So all I meant to say is that once they're broken up into pieces, they're still going to affect one failing is still going to affect the other failing in as much as it affects everything else. So you still have to deal with that complexity issue.
Yeah, I think, you know, the London whale trade's a little bit different too. And Felix, I can already feel you disagreeing with me, but that was one trade that went bad. And while there was ambiguity about how bad it had gone, it wasn't necessarily the same sense of, oh shit, are all the banks going wrong? Can we trust any financial institution? And just kind of like a run on them. It was just one issue that JP Morgan was trying to address. So I don't think
it was symptomatic of what Kathy is talking about, though, which is essentially something which is sometimes called too big to manage.
Yeah.
That these banks are so enormous and so complex that it's actually impossible to keep a handle on what everyone's doing.
One of the things I like about Neil's speech is he actually, and I'd never heard this said before, but like he actually said, we want banks to be able to fail. Like, we want them to make ridiculous mistakes and fail. The point is that we don't want that failure to ruin the economy for all of us. And I think he's right. That's what we're aiming at.
Yeah, I think, you know, the ideal a lot of people look back at, whether or not it's correct to do so, is kind of the savings and loan crisis, where lots and lots and lots of little banks did fail, and it did not it wasn't good for the economy, but it didn't.
But it was horrendously expensive. The cost of bailing them out was enormous.
You're getting to the next point I was going to make, which is that what a lot of people don't realize is that we ended up spending, I think, like $124 billion. Like, it wasn't like we got that money back. It was just outright the government had to spend.
Yeah, TARP was cheaper.
TARP, we made a profit on bailing out these giant banks that survived, whereas these banks did not survive, and so it cost the taxpayers money, which I think gets to the very important question of why don't we like too big to fail? Is it that the bailouts themselves are a bad thing, or is it, again, that we're worried that if they have this implicit guarantee that they're too big to fail and therefore they're never going to have any downside risk to their gambles, that they're just going to gamble a lot? And I think that's really what people are worried about, they're too big to fail, that it's going to lead to more risky behavior on Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, there's a case to be made. If you're a regulator, if you're a Treasury Secretary, and you want a financial system that you can oversee and make sure you know what's going to happen and doesn't have systemic risk, actually a smaller number of bigger banks that you can really be all up in their business and monitoring very carefully is advantageous. You have something like the savings and loan crisis that you mentioned, where it's hundreds of banks around the country. You know, now you can argue that, then you have a political economy problem, where if you have only a few very large banks, which is basically the European system in most European countries, if you only have a few very large banks, they get very intertwined with the political system. They lobby to have low capital requirements. They lobby to have weak regulation. Former government officials go to work for them. And that's a kind of corrupting influence in its own way. So you can, but it's not a one-way thing. There's trade-offs either direction.
And the way I see it is that what we've done up until now has been what you might think of as an evolutionary approach to regulating banks, to making sure that you know they're safe. We went from Basel I to Basel II to Basel III, and this complexity question, which Kathy brought up, goes all the way back to the 1970s in a bank called Bank Herstatt, which Neil knows about, but probably the other two of you don't, which went bust, I think, in the late 70s, kind of overnight. And it was this tiny bank in like Liechtenstein or something, and no one had ever heard of it. But because it was right in the middle of the foreign exchange markets, what had happened is people had made one leg of a foreign exchange trade with it, and then it never managed to make the other leg. And people wound up with these huge imbalances and being owed massive amounts of money by this bust bank, and they rippled out throughout the entire financial system, and the entire European banking system was very, very seriously hurt by the failure of this one tiny bank. And so then the Bank for International Settlements and various other technocrats start stepping in and shoring up, you know, FX stuff, derivative stuff, and anything else which they can see which might present this kind of systemic problem. And they start putting in rules, and the Basel Accords and Dodd-Frank and everything else kind of patches up bits and pieces of systemic risk here and there, which is great. And even Neil Kashkari in his speech said, you know, we have done a lot of good in Dodd-Frank. But then you know, there's nothing, there's no one particular thing you can point to. And so then that allows someone like Bernie Sanders or Neil Kashkari to come and say, we need to solve Too Big to Fail, as though there's like one big thing that you can do which solves the problem. And I don't think there is.
Well, so can I bring up the next thing he had on his list?
Aside from breaking, can, but not quite yet.
Okay.
Because... Because we need to talk about Harry's razors first.
Oh, well, of course.
We need to, because this podcast would not be possible were it not for our lovely sponsors, one of whom is Harry's razors, which two of us in this room, like, you know, shave on a semi-regular basis. Neil is very smart and, you know, has a well-trimmed beard. But...
You didn't mention my well-trimmed beard.
Your beard is so well-trimmed, I can't even see it.
It's also purple as well.
Harry's Razors is this kind of fascinating company, which they bought an entire razor factory in Germany, you know, super high-end five-blade razors, and they're selling them direct to consumers, and what that means is you get, like, top-of-the-range razors, which shave really well, at very low prices. Like, literally... half the price of what you'd pay in a drugstore for your standard razor, but it's just as good. Over 1 million guys have already made the switch. Thousands more are doing it every day. So this is what you do if you want to try this thing out. Instead of paying $32 for an 8-pack of blades, you can get them for $15 plus a razor plus moisturizing shave cream. You can do better than that if you use my promo code. So get $5 off your first order with promo code MONEY. Stop overpaying for a great shave and start the new year off right. Go to harrys.com right now. That's HARRYS.com. Enter code MONEY at checkout and you'll get $5 off. Okay, Jordan.
Yeah, so number two on his list, after just straight up breaking up the banks, was to make the banks really boring. That's a summary of it, which is turn them into highly regulated public utilities. And he wasn't 100% clear on everything that would be involved in that, but I took it as basically jacking up their capital requirements. And that's
well, he said that quite
well. He did
quite explicitly. He said forcing them to hold so much capital that they virtually can't fail.
Yeah.
With regulation akin to that of a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, so the regulation part is the how much, what else is he going to do with it? But basically just stuff them full of capital. And so we have to talk about what capital is.
Yes.
But a lot of people do think of this as sort of the one big thing that, interestingly, isn't really ending Too Big to Fail. It's just ending the fail part. That's, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't, like, if you have what's known as narrow banking, and we had a little bit of disagreement over email about whether he was talking about narrow banking here or not. But if you have this thing called narrow banking, then banks basically can't fail in any kind of systemic way, no matter how big they are, because you lose the engine of modern capitalism, which is fractional reserve banking. First, Jordan, what is capital?
So capital is... basic, the simplest way to explain it is it's a bank's assets minus its liabilities, right? It's
okay, so first of all, and the first thing which we need to say is that when you're talking about banking, the concept of assets and liabilities kind of gets put on its head.
It does. It gets complicated, but it's for now. Let's just make it very simple. It's that what you own minus what they owe to other people. Another way to put it...
Well, what you are owed is your assets.
Yes.
What you owe to other people is your liabilities.
Yes. And so another really simple way to put what capital is it's the funding a bank gets that they don't have to pay back to anyone. It's funding from issuing stock to people, from keeping their earnings. It's money that they can use to do business and to make loans to other people that they don't ever have to repay because they didn't borrow it in the first place. So why is that important? The easiest way to understand it is thinking about like a mortgage and a house, right? If you buy a house for like $100,000 and you put a 20% down payment on that house, so you own $20,000 worth of it, if your house goes down 20%, you're wiped out. However, if you made a 30% down payment and it goes down 20%, you still have some of your assets left. You still have some of your equity left in that house.
And when you say wiped out, you mean that you've put $20,000 in that house. You owe $80,000 to the bank for the mortgage.
Yeah.
And now your house is worth $80,000.
Exactly. So basically you owe everything.
You still owe the $80,000, but you only have an asset with $80,000. So net, you have nothing.
Exactly. And the upside is now if your house goes up in value, your returns get higher because you borrowed that money and you still only owe $80,000 to the bank, but maybe your house is now worth $120,000, so you make a pure profit on top of that. So that's why people think that when you have a lot of leverage, when a bank basically borrows a lot, it makes them more dangerous. If they do more of their business with equity or by using capital, then it makes them safer because if their assets go down in value, they still are less likely to go bust and become insolvent.
That's okay, kind of like saying I have an 80% down payment on my house instead of a 20%.
Okay, exactly. So here's the other way to look at it. If I lend Kathy $20,
yeah,
I'm not a bank. I'm just lending her $20, which I have. It's my money, and there's no real risk there. But if I borrow that $20 from Neil and then lend it on to Kathy, now I'm a bank because I have assets and I have liabilities. And then it's the difference between the assets and the liabilities, which is the capital, which we're talking about. And one of the things that, like, Martin Wolf at the FT and various other people have started talking about is this idea called narrow banking, where there are no liabilities, basically. Where you only lend your own capital and you have 100% capital.
Yeah. I don't think that's what Kashkar is going for. I think what he's saying instead is that essentially he's talking more like a 20-25%
So this is like Anathad Murthy at Stanford has been saying for a long time now. Banks typically have run around 8-10% capital ratios, and she's saying that should go up to about 30%.
Yeah. And so why this is, again, this is just making banks safer. And so, but to really make the whole financial system safer, you kind of have to extend it beyond banks because there's a possibility then you're going to get, well, what do you do about hedge funds? What do you do about, you know, other players out? What do you do about insurance companies?
So, Neil, this is the question for you since you're the one who actually knows what you're talking about here. This is also the debate between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. If we make the bank super safe by forcing them, say, to have 30% capital ratios, is it true, as Hillary Clinton has said many times, all that does is it pushes the risk into what she calls the shadow banking system?
I think it does. I think that's our experience. Now, there are other regulatory things that can happen to try and contain that, and that's what Hillary Clinton is proposing. But, you know, we've seen this over and over again. We've seen the rise of, so, for example, money market mutual funds, very common savings vehicle in the United States. They were created as a regulatory workaround 30 years ago, when there were caps on interest rates, back when interest rates were 20% back in the early 80s. And this was a workaround because banks couldn't charge that high an interest rate, but money market mutual funds were a bank-like savings vehicle that could. There's this long history. Hedge funds, a lot of hedge funds, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage finance industry, of things that are, for whatever reason, banks don't want to do or can't do, migrating into other spheres. Now, you can say regulators should be attuned to that, too, and that's why part of the construct of Dodd-Frank is the Financial Risk Oversight Council based out of the Treasury. But there's always going to be this kind of water flowing out of wherever the hole is in the boat.
So when Neil Kashkari says that one of the ways to end too big to fail is to make banks a lot safer, is that really thinking too narrowly? Because it's like, great, you've made the bank safer, but now everything else which isn't a bank has become riskier.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, my impression of Bernie Sanders is he puts a lot of weight on what I mentioned earlier, this political economy story where the big banks have too much power in Washington, too interconnected with the government, and that this is the original sin, the central flaw in our financial system. I think that does exist. That is an important problem. But there's a lot of risk in the financial world that doesn't really have to do with, you know, a bunch of ex-Clinton administration people working for Citigroup or Goldman Sachs people working for the government.
Well, the problem is that there just are so many problems. You know, actually Neil Kashkari in his speech said, you know, just because this won't solve every problem doesn't mean we shouldn't try to solve this problem. And I kind of agree with him. Like, there is a lobbying problem, there is a too big to fail and a moral hazard problem. Like right now, the moral hazard problem hasn't gone away, right? We have large, very large banks. They are pretty regulated, but not so regulated that we don't suspect they're again, hoarding risk.
Well, the moral hazard problem is this idea that very large banks can borrow at lower rates because everyone knows they're going to pay it back, because everyone knows that when push comes to shove, if they get into trouble, they'll get bailed out by the government. That problem has actually been solved to a large degree by this thing called the SIFI surcharge, the fact that these banks have to hold more capital precisely because they are systemically important.
I don't think the moral hazard is only about their interest rates. I think moral hazard is more generally just about the fact that anyone who works in one of those big banks isn't worried about going bankrupt. They know that they can risk their banks bottom line, and that the government will bail them out. That's a much more general concept.
Yeah, and that was fundamentally what we were talking about before. Why do we care about too big to fail? And I think that is closer to it than the actual bailouts, which in the end, I mean, we're worried about people blowing themselves up. We're not worried about bailing them out afterwards.
Go ahead. It's worth thinking about what the U.S. government approach to the too big to fail banks is now, because people act like nothing's happened. Well, a lot has changed. They're have a lot higher capital requirements. Basically, Dodd-Frank and the Basel III agreements internationally are basically saying, if you're a big systemically important bank, if you have $50 billion or more in assets, if we judge that you're one of these really risky institutions, you're going to have higher capital requirements than other types of firms. We're going to regulate you much more intensively. And then you make your choices as a bank. You know, the idea is if you say it's not worth it, you divest businesses, you kind of narrow what your focus into the things that make you smaller. And we have seen evidence of that happening. Now, we still have very large banks. We still have J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and the others. But to suggest nothing's changed, I think, isn't quite right.
And just to reiterate something you kind of hinted at earlier, America's banks are way smaller than virtually any other country in the world. That we have way more banks. We have thousands of banks. There's no other country like with thousands of different banks. And as a percentage of, as related to the size of the economy, even the big banks are much smaller than the ones you see in Europe.
I just got to jump in though. We haven't talked much about derivatives, right? And derivatives are tricky things because they typically, for example, those swaps, you enter them without cost, but they can blow up. So there's also, in other words, you know, it doesn't really add to your liabilities, but it does add to your risk. And that's something we haven't talked about. And American banks, even though they are, well, you might say small by international standards, they are also inventors of these kind of explosive instruments.
But yeah, it's true. But that said, you know, Deutsche Bank has an enormous derivatives book as well. Yeah. It's not like the American banks have some kind of like monopoly on derivatives.
No, I just want to say that we're not having a complete conversation if we don't talk about derivatives.
That's true.
I actually have a kind of backtracking question, but I'm kind of dwelling on it, so I feel like there's got to be some other listener who is. We talked about the issue of, you know, risk existing outside of the banks. Is there any reason the government couldn't just say we want to up capital requirements, not just for banks, but for literally anybody who buys and sells securities? Like, is there any reason it couldn't do? I mean, because that would be how you get through the shadow banking system.
But that's you. I mean, everyone with a brokerage account is someone who buys and sells securities.
I guess if you're a broker dealer, or like, is there some way you could like?
Does that include mortgages?
I guess maybe. I mean, I don't know. I actually don't know the answer
to
the question.
The reason why banks are regulated is because they are depository institutions, right? If you deposit money at a bank, then you need a certain amount of faith that bank is going to pay you back. If lenders in general are not that regulated, if I can lend you $100, the government is not going to regulate that.
Yeah.
Because that's just the worst thing that happens is I don't get paid back, and like, who cares if I don't get paid back? So it's a lot easier to regulate banks on the basis that they're depository institutions, they're FDIC insured, and all of that kind of stuff. If you're just talking about people moving money around the financial system, hedge funds, you know, investors, and so forth, becomes hard to even define what capital is in that case, and certainly it becomes much harder to regulate them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, people, before the crisis, you forget this, but back in 2006, people were talking about hedge funds as the big node of risk in the system. You heard a lot of that talk 10 years ago. Of course, the crisis, it's not that hedge funds didn't play a role in certain circumstances, but in general, this is a crisis of mortgage-backed securities and the giant banks. I think what we've seen is as of right now, hedge funds can fail, and it's not clear that it really matters to the broader economy.
There was only one which caused any kind of a systemic risk, and that was LTCM, what, like 15 years ago?
Right.
Yeah, 20 years ago. And hedge funds just aren't that levered anymore.
And I also want to add, like, talking about progress, like, one of the other things we've had progress in is standardization of contracts like swaps. And that actually improves complexity and makes it easier for things like hedge funds to fail.
But there is one more thing on Neil Kashkari's list, which we are going to come to just after I talk about Texture, which is our other sponsor this week, which is basically every single magazine that you ever want to read on your iPad. And you just pay one subscription fee, which is less than just buying three magazines at the newsstand. And then you get everything, whether it's The New Yorker, whether it's Consumer Reports, whether it's Men's Health or GQ, or it's all of the Condé Nast magazines, the Hearst magazines, you name it, they're all there, and you get to look through the back issues. It's searchable. You get to search on topics across issues. There are whole curated sections on certain subjects. You should try it out for free because it's awesome. And if you go to texture.com/slatemoney, then you will get an extra discount if you choose to subscribe, which you probably will because it's kind of awesome. So try Texture for free right now. Go to texture.com/slatemoney. So yes, there is one last thing which was on Neil Kashkari's list. He said there are three things we can do, three specific things we can do. Number one was breaking up the banks. We've talked about that. Number two was turning the banks into utilities by forcing them to hold more capital. We talked a bit about that. And then number three is this fascinating one where he goes, taxing leverage throughout the financial system to reduce systemic risks wherever they lie. And that's kind of what Jordan was just talking about. He's like, let's not just look at the banks here. And again, I think what's happened here is Neil Kashkari has gone way off topic. He started off talking about too big to fail, and now he's talking about leverage throughout the financial system. These are two different things. But is this something which can be done? Because even if hedge funds were not part of the cause of the crisis, the big, deep underlying cause of the crisis, if you can say there was one big, deep cause of the crisis, was leverage in various different forms in various different places. So if we tax it, if we make leverage less attractive, does that help things? Paul Volcker is a fan of this. I'm a fan of this. Nassim Taleb is a fan of this. I want to know, Neil, if you're a fan of this. Abolishing the tax deductibility of interest.
Yeah, I was going to go exactly there. You know, there are all these ways the tax code in the U.S. and a lot of advanced economies really encourages taking on more debt and encourages levering up. On the corporate side, which you're suggesting, if you're a company and you borrow money to the hilt, the interest you pay is a deduction against your earnings, and so it's called the tax shield. You have every incentive to lever up as much as you possibly can to maximize the value of that tax shield. It happens on the individual level too. Mortgage interest in the U.S. is deductible. Other types of expenses you have,
like
around
rent,
housing or not,
for instance,
right? Rent is not deductible, but the mortgage interest you pay is. That gives you every incentive as a homeowner to borrow as much money as you possibly can. These are incentives throughout the system that really do encourage debt. And I think, you know, you saw from 1980 to the onset of the crisis in 2008, this dramatic rise in all types of debt, financial sector debt, household debt, corporate debt. That's the original sin here. That's the central problem. How can the tax code disincentivize that? I think you just mentioned one.
And just to be very clear, when we talk about leverage and when we talk about debt, that's the same thing. They're just two different words for the same thing.
And I mean, as I understand it, and I, by the way, didn't know this until I was forced as a quant at a hedge fund to take a class in this corporate structure stuff. It's amazing. It has a very strong effect, as you mentioned. It basically allowed the corporate raiders movement to happen. I mean, that if you look into why all those companies were taken over and all that mergers and all that acquisitions happened, it's because of this weird tax issue.
So what is now known as private equity used to be known as leveraged buyouts. The name is, the word is right there in the name. A leveraged buyout is basically where you buy a company by taking out a mortgage on that company.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking, I'm kind of laughing about this politically because this is such a huge battle. I mean, probably bigger than breaking up the banks in some ways, because it touches all of corporate America. And the funniest thing about it is the Republicans have actually suggested something like this. If you look at their tax plans, a lot of them try to fund income tax cuts partly by getting rid of the break for interest, except for banks. That's literally that's the popular idea now, is eliminating it for everyone else except
that,
the banks.
But that makes sense. I'm with them on that.
Okay.
I do think that you should eliminate the tax deductibility of interest. I think that would decrease the amount of leverage in the system. But the whole point, most companies in the world can operate without borrowing money.
Yeah.
Banks, you cannot
have. That is the business.
You cannot have fractional reserve banking without borrowing money.
Yeah.
That's core to what you do. That is your business. And that's why we have so much, one of the reasons why we have so much banking regulation. You regulate banks separately. I don't think it makes sense to completely abolish the tax deductibility of interest for banks.
You could, however.
It is a legit. Interest expenses are a legitimate business expense for banks.
So I have a follow-up question then. So is this idea of taxing leverage by getting rid of the deduction something that literally applies to everyone but the banks? It's a way of making sure hedge funds and insurance companies, et cetera, don't lever up too much, but the banks, we deal with them through other means.
Well, we could also tax the banks at a smaller rate, or we could progressively tax the banks. We could progressively, in the sense of the size of the bank, that would be another way of actually promoting smaller banks. So you could kind of combine these things.
If you think that smaller banks are a good thing, which goes back to our first discussion.
Yes.
I think Barack Obama has proposed something along this line, not abolishing the tax deductibility of interest altogether, but at least sort of making little moves in that direction and making it maybe less deductible at the margin than it is right now. Is this possible? I mean, I feel like this is the one thing in Neil Kashkari's speech which is both a good idea and also conceivably possible, that it has bipartisan support.
Yeah, I wonder if I suspect this is the kind of thing that could only happen in the construct of a broad corporate tax overhaul that is a much bigger package. This is the kind of thing that might happen through that channel, not through the kind of financial regulatory, the next, you know, Dodd-Frank 2.0 kind of channel. But that said, I have no idea what the
audience. What would it look like for businesses? What would happen to businesses? I mean, of course, they'd complain about it, but it would actually mean they would have less incentive to invest, right?
It would make it harder for them to borrow.
They would need to use more expensive forms of capital, meaning equity, meaning the kind of returns on equity would probably decline. It seems like it would be a pretty substantial change in the entire way that business works in America.
The idea that you can start a business by borrowing a bunch of money from the bank and then you pay the interest payments you pay to the bank are tax deductible is a very core idea. I'm sure there will be lots of Congress people saying, but you're hurting small businesses if you do this. And to a certain extent, you would be.
Yeah. And what about other countries? Do they have this tax issue?
The tax codes are very different in different countries. But no, it's true that in most countries, interest payments for businesses, but not individuals, tend to be tax deductible.
I do think something we've kind of missed here is we've talked about this all from a systemic risk standpoint and from a what's good for the economy standpoint. Keep in mind, there is some amount of what big banks do that is creating value for their customers. And to just assume that there's no value in what a JP Morgan or a Citigroup does all day, I think is kind of unfair. And if let's say you're a big airline and you want to be able to hedge the price of fuel to make sure that you don't have wild swings, you need a big derivatives desk to deal with to make that happen. Let's say you're a large company and doing business internationally, and you need trade finance to ship goods all over the world. That's something big banks can do pretty well. The question of how much financial innovation over the last generation has actually been valuable and how much has been kind of fake activity that's just, creating risk but not actually creating value for the world, I don't know where that lies. But to assume that there's no value in any of these products, I think, is
no, and I don't think anyone is saying that there's no value. They're just saying that for all the value that they provide, they're also creating tail risk and that we have to worry much more about those tails.
Or another way of asking this question is what's the margin between the banks we now have and another scenario where we have heavily nationalized or at least regulated banks?
And that other scenario actually has a good name. It's called Canada.
Yeah. Right.
And interestingly in Canada, Canada sailed through the crisis with very little difficulty, partly because commodity prices stayed high, but partly because they had a very safe banking system, and with very large, too-big-to-fail banks. Canada definitely has the too big to fail problem. But because the banks were carefully regulated, as Neil was saying, like if you have a small number of eggs in one basket, but then you keep a really close eye on that basket, that actually does kind of work.
Right. That's why I think too big to fail is kind of the wrong framing for a lot of these issues that we've been talking about that are really important.
So just finally, Neil, you were talking about how a big tax reform would be needed in order to enact some of this stuff. One of the weird things, kind of the weirdest thing about this speech from Neil Kashkari, is that it was not a central banker speech at all, really. It was a politician's speech. And what is this doing coming out of the mouth of a very brand new, newly hatched central banker?
Yeah, it's interesting. This was his very first speech as president of the Minneapolis Fed. And as you say, it wasn't the kind of very cautious, very, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand type of speech you usually get from central bankers. Also, I'll add, he's been out there. He's on Twitter. He tweeted on his train after that speech, here's the beer I'm having on the train. That's not what central bankers usually do. You could argue the traditional mold is fusty and out of date, and it's actually good to have our public officials really engaging with the public and more accessible. I think Neil Kashkari is clearly deliberately trying to be more open and less the man behind the curtain. It's definitely the opposite of, I believe, was Montagu Norman, the old governor of the Bank of England in the 19th century, never explain, never apologize. And this is kind of the opposite of that. It's explaining everything
One more question, kind of following on that. Does Neil Kashkari, a voluble central banker, have any power to do any of that? I mean, like, what can he actually affect change-wise?
Does the president of the Minneapolis Fed, is that worth more than a bucket of warm spit?
Or is it like a bully pulpit type thing?
less so on bank supervision like this. You know, so people who work for Neil Kashkari and the Minneapolis Fed, they supervise the banks in Minneapolis and Minnesota and North Dakota, a few surrounding states. I don't believe there are any large banks based in that Federal Reserve District, to the best of my knowledge. What's the biggest bank in Minnesota?
I feel like U.S. Bank Corp might be around.
The really giant banks, the J.P. Morgans, the Bank of Americas, they are not under that Reserve Bank. And on supervision policy, that really is run by the Board of Governors in Washington. So Dan Tarullo is a governor of the Federal Reserve System, probably the most powerful bank regulator in the world. All the policy decisions are made in Washington. The execution falls to these reserve banks around the country, but the most powerful of those is the New York Fed that oversees the big New York banks.
So was this internal fighting within the Federal Reserve system? Is this the president of a bank making a kind of like sub-tweety attack on Dan Tarullo?
I don't know.
or perhaps campaigning for the next time they're picking a Fed chair. Maybe all of a sudden Bernie Sanders is going to be interested in Neil Kashkari.
I will say this is not as completely new as it might seem. Tom Hanig was the president of the Kansas City Fed for a long time, was a very active, vocal opponent of Too Big to Fail. He's now at the FDIC. Now, that said, he was that vocal, active figure after being there 30 years, not after being there 2 months.
Yeah.
So a little bit of a different situation. Richard Fisher just left the Dallas Fed, was also pretty vocal on this stuff. So it's not as if this is unprecedented, but it is interesting to have such a vocal, powerful articulation of these ideas from somebody who's new to the institution and willing to kind of put it all out there and let people decide.
Okay. So I hope that has cleared up something, perhaps. We're going to come on to the numbers round, but first I need to tell you about Bolland Branch, which are my favorite sheets. And Kathy, you have an email.
I have an amazing email from Liz Peterson, who writes, "I've been listening to your podcast for some time and really enjoy them, but enough about your content. I'm compelled to write about the brilliance that is Felix Salmon promoting Bolland Branch sheets. Oh my God, thank you, Liz."
So thank you, Liz. And the reason why Liz is so into my Bolland Branch ad reads is because I kind of love my Bolland Branch sheets. And I sleep well in my Bolland Branch sheets, and they're soft and they're comfortable, and I can sleep well at night because they are fair trade, and I can sleep well at night because they're soft, and I can sleep well at night because I got a big discount because I used my order code. And so all I can say is, I'm going to reiterate this, sleep is hugely important, and anything which you're touching when you're sleeping is a really important thing. And even if you're not entirely conscious of what you're touching when you're asleep, it affects things. So invest in some sheets. It's a good idea. And if you go to bollandbranch.com today, you'll get 20% off everything. It's duvet covers, it's sheets. They even have towels, everything. So go to bollandbranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and brunch.com. Get 20% off the entire order if you use the promo code MONEY. Bollandbranch.com, promo code MONEY. Sleep well at night. Dream well at night. Be happier, healthier. You know, when you sleep better, you are less likely to get Alzheimer's disease. It's true. Okay, it's the numbers round. Jordan.
Okay, my number is 5.3%, and there's been like a big wonk fight, Neil, you know what I'm talking about, for the past several days on kind of online blogs, whatever, about how much Bernie Sanders thinks he can make the economy grow if he passes his entire platform. And there is essentially, it's a long, complicated story. An economist said he could do an average of 5.3% a year, which is sort of unbelievable. However, I mean, people made fun of Jeb Bush when he suggested 4%. 5.3% is doing that one better. However,
if 4 is good, then 5 is better, right?
That would be fantastic if it were all.
I want to run for residence and say I'm going to have 20% growth.
Yeah, it's the
but Felix. I'll do 22. So it's good luck.
This actually happened in the campaign. I think Mike Huckabee said like 8% growth after Jeb said 4% growth. It's like the Jonathan Chait had it pretty well. It's like the 5-minute abs problem. You know, 6-minute abs. What about 5-minute abs? Anyway, regardless of what you think about Sanders' campaign and his sense of economic realism, it does bring up this question of how much can the U.S. economy actually grow going forward? And that's a really fascinating debate that one day I would like to argue with people about, perhaps on this podcast. But I do think we're going to hopefully see a little bit more discussion about what our actual potential as a country economically is and whether or not we're living up to it. So,
okay. Neil, do you have a number?
I have a number that's closely related to that one. My number is 4. That is the number of former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House who wrote a joint letter criticizing those Sanders economic estimates and forecasts. I think there's a really interesting battle brewing in the kind of left of center policy world. You know, a lot of people from more the wonk side of things, the economists, the policy people who maybe work for the Obama administration, maybe a think tank in D.C., maybe Capitol Hill, they're skeptical of the Sanders approach. And they feel like Bernie Sanders is you know, trashing their efforts on Dodd-Frank, on Obamacare, on all the policies of the last few years, and that they're more rigorous. And seeing how that battle shapes up is going to be really interesting. If Bernie Sanders becomes the Democratic nominee, is he going to ultimately bring all of these people on the kind of broader left coalition along, or is he going to remain true to his kind of democratic socialist, really kind of populist anti-establishment approach?
My number is 77. And this is a little bit of a wonky number, but I'm fascinated by this one. Apple Computer is one of the biggest, if not the biggest company in the world. It is its balance sheet is unbelievably rock solid. They have more money than they know what to do with. They spend gazillions of dollars on share buybacks and still have more cash than they started with. They are hugely profitable. They have very little debt. And there's just basically, if you lend Apple Computer money, you can be absolutely sure that you will get it back. Even more sure, if you ask me, than if you lend your money to a bank. The rate at which banks borrow money is known as LIBOR. So when Apple prices bonds, when it borrows money, it prices off LIBOR. And if you ask me, I would lend Apple money at LIBOR minus something, because I think it's safer than banks. When Apple borrowed money in 2013, however, in one of its first big bond issues, it wound up paying for its 3-year bonds, it wound up paying 5 basis points more than LIBOR. It played LIBOR plus 5, it's known as. You pay 0.05%.
That's very small.
A very little thing above LIBOR. So the market said that Apple was just a minuscule bit more risky, or maybe just a little bit less liquid than bank debt. Apple came back to the market this week and did another 3-year floating rate bond with just as much creditworthiness as it had 3 years ago. And this time, its 3-year bonds priced at 82 basis points above LIBOR. Mm-hmm. That's it. They came 77 basis points wider than they did 3 years ago. And I don't know what this means, but that difference, the way it seems to have become harder for Apple to borrow money, I think that's interesting.
Is that like people are no longer confident in iPhone sales in China or something over the next 3 years?
I think it's definitely China. I don't think it's Apple specific. I think it's corporate credit in general has tightened up in a way that people haven't been paying a lot of attention to, but is kind of important in terms of the business cycle.
Interesting.
Well, that was a long story about the number 77. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that with mine.
It involved math. We had to do our own math to get to it.
So my number is 10,000. It's the number of backlogged rape kits that Ohio has gone through in the last 5 years. And it's resulted in 445 indictments. And the way they do it is they take the DNA from the rape kits and they compare it against a database of DNA. And then they find, hey, we know this person who raped somebody. It's actually kind of amazing. The White House has this initiative for the last few years of trying to get through the backlogged rape kits in this country. There are 400,000 of them. And, you know, in some sense, it's like, oh, it's a victory because we've gone through 10,000 of them. But in another sense, it's like, what are we doing that we haven't gone through this?
Why is there such a backlog? What's preventing people from testing them, like, in real time?
Yes. Well, it's money.
Yeah.
But it's something that I feel like we should... That should be paid for.
Yeah,
but also DNA testing is becoming cheaper, right? So it's like the longer you wait, the cheaper it gets to test these things.
I mean, look, we could have an entire episode about the way rape is or is not dealt with in this country, but I think this is symptomatic of that.
There's actually a banking angle here too, if I may, which is that the New York District Attorney's Office actually took some of its bank settlements and handed them over to other DAs in the office to do rape kit testing. So that is actually some of where this comes
from.
So
thank you, J.P. Morgan Fines. You have paid to get 435 rapists indicted. Yeah, some good can come from the financial crisis after all. That is it.
Slate pitch for us
this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Thank you to Audrey Quinn, the producer, Steve Lickteig, and Andy Bowers, the executive producers. Thank you, number one, mostly of everything, to the one and only Neil Irwin, who came in at almost zero notice and just managed to crush it. So, Neil, thank you for being here. Do subscribe to this show. Find us if you search for Slate Money in the iTunes store. Leave us a review. And check out all of the Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. So we'll talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hi, I'm Ezra Klein, editor-in-chief of Vox.com, and I've got a new podcast on the Panoply Network. It is called The Ezra Klein Show, which I'm never going to be able to say without feeling like a terrible, terrible narcissist. But it's long-form, intimate, real conversations with newsmakers, with politicians, policymakers, journalists, business leaders, people who are influencing the world in fascinating and important ways. We talk about what they think, why they think it, what they believe. I've really enjoyed getting a chance to talk with these people, and I hope you enjoy it too.